This is Scenic Roots, talking writing. Our guest is Nicholas Butler, whose most recent novel, Godspeed, a gothic tale of self-destruction in the service of a dream, more than one dream, in fact, has just been published. In this excerpt from the opening pages of the novel, the three principals are about to get their first glimpse of the house they're being challenged to finish under an impossible deadline. The reader is John Orsini.
This was the house that would change their fortunes. They could feel it. Cole had barely steered his pickup off the highway and passed through an open cattle gate before they began climbing the dusty canyon road north, and they could feel it. Money. Like a vibration in the crisp mountain air. It was humming out there, an expectancy, a promise. And they were driving toward it, cotton-mouthed, skin crawling. They could practically see it on the wind pushing the late summer leaves, swaying the yellowing meadow grasses, smiling down upon the dappled river water below. The whole world here looked like money. Money just waiting to be plucked up off the ground. The leaves like greenbacks, the shimmer of the water like silver coins. They needed this house, this break. They needed this work. Work for what sounded like as much as a year, maybe more. And not the thankless, backbreaking tedium they'd been reduced to for the past few years, either. No, this was something to build a reputation on. A name. Something to stake a man for decades. The kind of signature house a person could point to and proudly say, "I built that." Me. I built that. The kind of house that, 30 years from now, when they were all broken down old men, they could travel to with their grandchildren and be welcomed, like masters of some dying art. Bart rode in the passenger seat, blinking down at the chasm that had now fallen away just an arm's length from the gravel road. Not even a mile off the highway, and already the country was wild, wild, wild. Below the road snaked a river raging white and blue, cataracts tumbling. And above them, off the low mountainsides, wispy waterfalls spilled down like great lengths of silver-white hair. A prominent dip of chew bumped out Bart's lower lip, and by he spit into an empty Coca-Cola can. "I lived here almost 20 years, and I ain't ever been down this road," he said, peering over at Cole, who took the gravel track with white-knuckled respect. A blown-out tire wouldn't just be a pain in the ass out here. It would put them behind schedule for their noon meeting with the homeowner. "You ever been back here, Cole?" Cole shook his head no, fixing Bart with a meaningful look for as long as he dared before turning back to the road ahead of them. "This is big, pristine, private country," the look communicated. "You and me, we don't just get invited back here." "She told me she had a driveway punched in last summer," Cole said. "Another 2 miles or so off this road." He pointed an index finger up into the mountains. "Somewhere up in there, I'm guessing." "You imagine the kind of bread they're spending?" Teddy put in from the back seat of the extended cab. "I mean, a 2 mile driveway? Up here? That's an Army Corps type operation." "All that goddamn California money's what it is," said Bart. "Hell, that state's filling up. Cheaper for them to come out here and plop a house down on a mountaintop than it is to buy a nice two-bedroom in San Diego or Los Angeles. Cheaper to build a house in the clouds. Lunacy, you ask me." It had been an unseasonably warm spring and summer in western Wyoming, and now the mountain air was sweet with sage, the late August sky overhead deliriously blue and gauzed in cottony clouds. In the back seat, Teddy studied a gazetteer, biting his lower lip and running his fingers over the map. Bart hung an arm out the passenger side window as the truck began to pull away from the canyon side. Soon they passed through a glade of trees, and he reached out for the branch of a lodge pine, managing to snap off a handful of needles. Now the cab of the truck was filled with that smell, commingling with his Copenhagen chew, pine and mint and tobacco. All three men were dressed just a bit more presentably than usual. Unstained, newish Carhartt pants, plaid short-sleeved shirts with collars, scuffed work boots buffed up near to a shine. Cole glanced at himself in the rear view, tamping down his brown crew cut with his fingers and studying his newly shaved face. The razor burn beneath his jaw, his recently whitened teeth. Bart went to work with his pocket knife, cleaning beneath his fingernails, while Teddy sighed deeply and drummed his hands against his thighs.
It's an interesting situation. It kind of reminds me of what my life was like when I was a teenager, and I would find myself trying to talk my way into a job that I clearly wasn't really qualified for. I wanted it really badly, but, you know, I had some time to go before I could really honestly say, I'm ready to do this. So that, in some ways, seems to me to be the situation with the three principals in the story, Cole, Bart, and Teddy, who are friends, been friends all their lives. They formed a construction company together. But truth be told, at the point where the book starts, while they do have a nominal construction company, they've got a little logo on the side of their truck and all the rest of it, they're not really a construction company. They're really just three guys trying to survive.
Yeah, I think that's fair, and I think that's a good perception in the book, and one that I haven't heard yet so far, but that's right, yeah.
And then they meet this rich woman who offers them such a tantalizing proposition that, again, right, you know, despite the fact that they're really not, well, one could argue that they're qualified, but are they ready for it?
Right. Yeah, that's right. And I mean, I think that's part of the early mystery of the book is they're asking themselves the same question. Like, why us? You know? But the money is so good, and they're at such a difficult point in all their lives where they're willing to sort of overlook that why question and just go for the money grab. And I'm really interested in literary thrillers that have that sort of morality component, where at every turn the characters can make the right moral decision, but they never do. and that's what the characters in this book are going through. You know, they have moments where they can step back. They just don't.
When you say that the right moral decision, I'm assuming what you mean is for their own benefit, and probably even more so for the benefit of those who care about them. This is not a good place to go.
Well, yeah, and also, you know, making having decision making that's predicated on something other than money.
Mm. It could be argued that their primary motivation is this huge amount of money that this woman is dangling in front of them, but at the same time, I think they're also drawn to the challenge of building what would appear to be a dream house in a less than dream situation. Really, it's on the side of a mountain,
right,
in Wyoming.
yeah. I mean, I think part of the reason why I wrote this book, and it's not something I was thinking of when I launched into it, is back in 2013, 2014, my wife and I built a house outside of our hometown here in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, where I'm talking to you from.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was just really fascinated by the dynamic between the so-called homeowner, the person who's commissioning the house, and the guys who are working on it. Because in my experience, they were great guys. Many of them had gone to the same high school I'd gone to, and we could have easy conversations about, you know, different folks that we had in common, and the landscape and things like that. But there's an uncomfortable dynamic there too of differences in wealth disparity and what's possible in folks' lives. And I thought that was fascinating here in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, which is a pretty middle class, even lower middle class sort of environment. But then you take that out to Jackson, Wyoming, where there's such egregious wealth disparity, and play with it there. And it seemed like a really interesting way to write a book, you know, like rather than $250,000 house in Eau Claire, or even a $2 million house in Eau Claire, what is it like for some guy who's made zero money in his life, really, to be working on a $20 million architectural gem, you know? How does that change his perception of what's possible in his own life? Does it twist him? Does it poison him? It was fun to write. In a way.
In a way, yeah. Wow. Yeah, imagine yourself in that situation. A $20 million house, something that in your wildest dreams you're never going to live in. And yet, in some sense, you become a part of it.
Right. And once you're done, you know, and the crazy thing about construction is you construct somebody else's dream, and then there's a point where the house is done. And even though you've been, you know, kind of residing in it for months and months and months, then there's a moment where it's not, where you're evicted. You go back to your existence, and somebody moves in with this totally different lifestyle and opportunities. And that's fascinating to me.
I can certainly understand that, because there has to be some measure of ownership on the part of the guy building it, because they put so much of themselves into it.
Yeah, for sure. And in the case of the guys in the book, I mean,
let's talk about them. So the leader, nominally, although he's not entirely comfortable being the leader, and it's not clear that the other two are quite comfortable with him being the leader, but at the same time, as soon as he says, well, I don't want to be the leader, no, that's fine, you can be the leader, Cole. So Cole, who has some challenges in his own life, becomes the spokesperson for this trio.
Right. Yeah, there's four main characters in the book, and three of them are sort of childhood friends. They grew up in eastern Utah, and they make their way to Jackson in their early 20s. And they form this sort of fledgling construction company where mostly they've just been doing kind of crap jobs for 2-3 years. There's Cole, who's, as you say, kind of their ad hoc leader. He's newly single, and he's looking at this opportunity as a way to build the company's name and brand and maybe move himself up into the Jackson social scene. There's Teddy, who's kind of a simple guy. He's religious, and he's got a big family, big young family. He's married, and so he's looking at this as a way to somehow finally purchase some real estate, purchase a house in Jackson so that his family can be finally established and secure. And then the third corner of the triangle is Bart. And he's the loose cannon. He's had some drug problems in his life. And what his partners don't really know about him is that his knees are shot. And so he is not looking at this as a long-term solution. He's looking at it as a way out. And I like that. I mean, I guess all my books are somewhat about friendship. And I like the kind of blind corners that you get in friendship, where you might really love someone. You might have known them for decades, but you don't ever really, you can't know someone completely. And that's part of the fun of this book, is that, you know, you've got these four main characters, but you don't really know everyone's motivations exactly.
It strikes me, and it just struck me, to be honest, the relationship between the three male principals is kind of mice and menish.
Well, that's a nice thing to say.
You know, where Cole could be said to be the one who has the clearest vision, or at least the clearest vision that includes all three of them.
Yeah.
He's looking, in some sense, to sort of save his friends a little bit. Certainly, it seems both Cole and Teddy have been saving Bart off and on most of their lives. Because Bart is a little self-destructive, isn't he?
Yes, maybe even a lot self-destructive. Mm. I mean, that's a nice thing to say. I mean, of course, you know, when I was in my teenage years, especially just going through the public school libraries, I read all the Steinbeck I could get. Mm-hmm. And I don't think his books have aged one bit. I would never pronounce anything that I've worked on the level of a master like that. But I'd like to believe that the spirit of his work, resides in somebody like me who's interested in blue-collar America and lower-class America and male friendship and people that are struggling to get by. And, I remember the first time I finished East of Eden and just felt like the whole world had changed for me somehow.
I know that feeling. That's such a powerful book.
Yeah, and I don't think it's really aged either, you know, and it just, it takes its time. It's it's elegiac, it's epic, it's distinctly America. I don't know. I love Steinbeck. I don't know if that's in vogue to say anymore, but I love his work.
Well, East of Eden has always struck me as being biblical, especially Cain and Abel, right?
Yes, indeed.
So in that sense, and it would appear that your motivation is the same, you tap into these timeless stories. You may be telling a contemporary story, but it resonates through the ages because human nature doesn't change that much.
Well, that's nice. That's nice of you to say. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you know, at the center of this book, it's weird to write a literary thriller that, on the surface, is maybe mostly about American greed or some slightly warped version of the American dream. But then, you know, as I've had time to sort of think about it, I think about it a little bit as a love story, and that might seem absurd for a book that. It's got a lot of crystal meth floating around in it. But, you know, the three guys are kind of the wheels of the literary vehicle that are driving the story forward. But you don't understand the heart of the story, and you can't understand the motivation or the why of the story without Gretchen. And that's why the house is built where it is, and that's why there's a deadline. And the more I thought about the book, the more that I realized, like, this is a character who's deeply in love with the landscape and has all these unresolved feelings for her parents and who had her heart broken in a specific way at that location. And I remember hearing one time that Mark Danielewski, who wrote House of Leaves, never considered it to be a horror book. He always thought it was a love story. And I remember the first time thinking about that and just being like, that seems absurd. But it's funny how you can bury certain emotions in something that's otherwise really dark.
Well, it also strikes me that it's a book about dreams and the danger of marrying your dreams. Sometimes you have to step back from them a little bit and say, yeah, this is what I want, but is this really what I want?
Right. Yeah. I mean, when we built this house that I'm talking to you from back in 2014, I think it was some component of what I imagined my own American dream to be about, like establishing a vision for a structure that my family would live in for decades and decades. And I just kind of blindly went about that. And this house is nothing like the house inside the book, but it was only after we were done and we moved into the house that I really began questioning why I was even doing that. Was I any happier in a new house? Of course I wasn't. I was the same guy I was before. And I feel like that's a lot of America, or maybe the world in 2021. We're just like barreling towards something sort of blindly without asking a whole lot of questions about why, you know.
Yeah, I do. It's been posited a number of times that that's partly what this pandemic has been all about, that we were on the back of a motorcycle going too fast, and the pandemic came, and all of a sudden the driver took his hand off the accelerator. Stop for a minute. What are you doing?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's an interesting approach that you took, I have to say, Nicholas, to, in effect, it's kind of like method acting in that you put yourself in the position of these three men being asked to do something that, at least on the face of it, I don't know anything about construction, but on the face of it, it would appear to be impossible. It's the fall when they're talking to this woman about building this dream house for her, the house is kind of started, but it's nowhere close. It doesn't even have a roof on it, and she's asking them to finish it by Christmas.
Right.
So you put yourself in that same position of saying, okay, well, what does it feel like to have that kind of deadline? You wrote the book in what, 3 or 4 months?
Yeah. I started it back in early 2019, and I had a new book out at that time, my fourth book, Little Faith. And independent bookstores mean a lot to me. So I was to put it lightly. And I was out there aggressively touring. I think I visited like 50 independent bookstores and libraries and, I don't know, the first 8 months of 2019. And during that time, any second that I could get to work on this book, I took it. When I was picking up my kids from school or taking them to swim practice or whatever it was, I wrote. It was the first time I'd ever been on a book tour where I actually took my computer into the hotel, and rather than just relaxing at the end of the night, I wrote. And it left me, you know, other writers might be able to write a lot quicker than me, but normally I give myself 2 years to work on something. And when I was done with the book, you know, I felt desolate. You know, I'm really proud of the book. I think it's a timely book, and it talks about, in a lot of ways, what's happening in the real estate market right now. But I felt kind of grimy. I felt a little raw, you know, because I'd been with these guys, and it was hard. I like the idea of method acting. I hadn't quite thought of it that way, but of course, what novelist wouldn't want to think of themselves in the league of like Robert De Niro or something?
Well, I was talking to a writer yesterday, and we just kind of agreed that whenever you start writing a book, you are in effect creating a world.
Yeah.
And you know, he was describing it as a kind of godlike position to be in, where you can make the world exactly the way you want it to be.
Yeah.
You can make characters do the things you want them to do. And then, as you said in a conversation with somebody about the book, it's fun to write about rich people.
Yeah, that's
for that
right.
Same reason, right? Because it gives you so much latitude.
It's absolutely true. We used to talk about that in grad school, too. You know, I mean, I grew up middle class, Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and I love writing about quotidian characters, blue-collar characters. But they can't quite do the stuff that an uber-wealthy person can do. And that was one of the interesting things about, you know, hearing the anecdote that would become the seed of the story. It was just thinking, like, well, what kind of person has that sort of money, you know, where she can just disregard people's safety and dangle this giant financial carrot out in front of them? That was really... It seemed like almost a villainous sort of thing. It was doing the work and really trying to understand somebody's motivation in a 360 sort of degree way. Like, okay, well, that might be a villainous act, but there must be a good reason behind that. And that was the fun part about writing the Gretchen character and understanding her motivations.
Yeah, she's a really interesting character, but it was fascinating to me that somebody told you a similar story in Eau Claire, a friend of yours who's in construction and was and an offer like that was made to him, and I'm wondering how did that play out in reality? Did they continue to pursue that, or did they at some point just say, look, there's just no way we can do this?
Yeah, I'm sure they didn't laugh in that homeowner's face, but in 2014 when we finished this house, we had this family friend come over to look at our place, and he was telling me about this construction of a home not so far away from us, and a big house, multi-million dollar house, which is unusual for this part of the world, and they'd slip behind their deadline, and the homeowner said, you know, if you guys can finish this house in the next 3 weeks, I'll give you all a five-figure bonus. And my buddy turned to me and said, Nick, if we had all the meth in the world, we couldn't have finished it in 3 weeks. And, but the interesting thing about being a novelist is asking, well, what would have happened if they had?
Exactly.
You know, what would that 3 weeks have looked like? So that was the fun challenge of the book.
No doubt. I'm wondering, about your methodology, what your professor in graduate school would have said if you told him that's how you were going to write a book, putting yourself on that deadline and saying, I'm going to write this in 4 months.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, you know, what he would have said to you if you had told him that's what you're planning to do.
Well, I think, you know, I was fortunate at Iowa to have four workshop teachers, you know, that affected me in different ways. But maybe the most important one was James Allen McPherson, whose work means the world to me and whose spirit means the world to me. And I think he actually would have cautioned me.
that's what occurred to me too. Yeah.
Yeah, I think he might have said, "Well, why are you doing that? And are you going to be okay at the end?" He was a deep soul, and I think he might not have undertaken that challenge. But of course, he's written, you know, much different work than me. But
so, what was the takeaway from that experience for you?
Probably that I won't do that again, but that I think it worked as an experiment. And, you know, I'm five books into my career, and so I'm looking for different ways to challenge myself and to keep things fresh. And I've been really fortunate. I've been so fortunate to just go after whatever story I wanted to pursue, and regardless of genre or marketing. I don't worry about where it's going to fit in on a shelf. I just worry about keeping things interesting for me. And I had a lot of fun writing the thriller. I felt like kind of raw and a little bit grimy at the end. But, it felt a little bit like running like a race, you know? I completed the race. And I don't know. When you're a writer, you realize that that's, I don't know. You got to figure out ways to challenge yourself to get things done. That, you know, there's all these ideas in writers' heads, but the challenge is sitting there and getting it out.
Well, you said at one point, again, in a conversation, that you both understand and revere manual labor. And it seems to me that having done what you've just done, you got deeper inside the head of people who work paycheck to paycheck and often do the kind of work that takes a huge toll on their bodies.
Yeah. Well, I think the reason why I revere folks that work hard jobs is during my 20s, I never had any luck finding a job. It wasn't a great period in America. The early aughts weren't a great time to come out of college with an English degree. And so I worked some difficult manual jobs. You know, I was a meat packer at an Oscar Mayer plant. I worked in a liquor store. I was a coffee roaster. And all along the way, the folks that I worked with always treated me so well, even though they knew that I didn't quite fit in. When I was working as a meat packer, they used to tease me, like, "Aren't you glad you got a college education so you could work here with us?" But they also joked with me. And, you know, when days were dragging and I didn't want to work there, they kept my spirits high. And so I just have a profound respect for people that do the work that really keeps our country moving forward. And I like telling those stories.
Thank you for the book, and thank you for the conversation. The insights that you're offering are Steinbeckian, and they are going to transcend this moment and this book. You know, that's I think what any writer is shooting for, right?
Well, I appreciate that. I certainly hope so. And, you know, five books into my career, I really appreciate support from journalists like you and the indie booksellers that push my books and the librarians. And so I don't take it for granted. And thank you so much.
Yeah, you know, the joy of a creative life, eh?
Yeah, it is a joy because I haven't had a real boss in a long time. And I get to hang out with the imaginary people in my head and do exactly what the 16-year-old version of myself always dreamed of. But it ain't fortune and glory either.
It's been a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks for taking the time to talk.
Thank you, Richard. I appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure.
Yep, mine too. Bye-bye.
Nicholas Butler's most recent novel, Godspeed, has just been published. This is Scenic Roots on listener-supported public radio in Chattanooga.